ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Christopher Skase. Young, handsome, entrepreneur. He finds epic success in the 80s.
He came with that cowboy energy. He was doing big things.
Skase becomes a media mogul.
He outbid the legendary Rupert Murdoch.
His empire teeters, but he outfoxes them all. I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The name is Mamdani.
Well, in many ways, it's the story of the week. Zoran Mamdani has become the mayor of New York City.
Yeah, there's definitely an excitement around this race that I don't think we've seen, at least not for a Democratic candidate, in a very long time, Hamish.
And weirdly, it's flooding social media channels here in Australia as well. So is Zoran Mamdani the saviour that the Democrats have been desperately searching for, or could he in fact be part of their curse?
I'm Amelia Lester in the seat for Geraldine Doogue.
Hey, Amelia. It's Hi. Hamish here as well, and this is Global Rhyming. Well, Geraldine is roaming a whirlwind trip overseas, and I wanted to introduce Amelia Lester for the first time on Global Roaming. Do you want to tell us who you are?
Yes, I'm so excited to be here. My name is Amelia Lester. I am a deputy editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. That's a magazine that's based in Washington, D.C., but I am an Australian, and I've been back living in Australia for the last year or so.
So does that mean that Ravi Agrawal is your boss?
He is my boss. He will be listening. I hope he gives me good marks.
We loved when you came on, Ravi, so we'd like to have you back. So this week we are turning our sights on the United States, weirdly covering a mayoral race in one American city, but I guess fair to observe it's had kind of outsized influence and reaction. Do you want to set it up for us? Why does it actually matter?
Yeah, I don't think we often talk about mayoral races internationally, but I've never seen enthusiasm for a candidate like this, not since, I would say, Barack Obama, particularly amongst young people. They love his presence on social media, but more than that, I'd say they love how radical and what a departure from form his policy proposals are. Zoran Mamdani is a 34-year-old. He's the first Muslim mayor of New York City. He's the first South Asian mayor of New York City, and he's the youngest mayor the city's seen in over 100 years.
I was chatting to a friend earlier who's based in DC but's been in New York this week, and she said she got to New York and saw a headline saying that Mamdani, the first Muslim mayor candidate, had been to meet with some of the leaders of New York's Hasidic Jewish community on his way to visiting a gay bar in the final hours of his sort of campaign. So he's clearly cutting across a lot of, I suppose, the lines, the friction points that you might see in an electoral race in the United States at the moment. I think what stood out to me in terms of trying to understand Mamdani is that he's cutting through here in a strange way, in Australia. So our producer, Taryn, has been, honestly, Taryn, banging on about this for weeks, but it's everywhere on social media, whether it's TikTok, Instagram, the other platforms. There's something about his videos that the algorithm is picking up or that young Australians are responding to. I know that's been the case in other countries. It's very difficult to measure this sort of thing, but as one snapshot, in the 48 hours around the Melbourne Cup, New York Mayor was actually the second most searched thing in Australia after the Melbourne Cup. So this is somehow arriving on people's radars. Perhaps, you know, we could compare it to the way people are kind of fixated on Trump.
Yeah, and the fascinating thing is that he kind of came out of nowhere earlier this year. An Emerson College poll in February showed him coming in at 1%. He was lagging behind all other six potential candidates for mayor. So it's really been a crazy turnaround. I think what's really relevant to Australia about this is people in the US are wondering whether he's the future of the Democratic Party. I think young people around the world are looking to him as maybe a model for how they want politicians to be in the social media age in 2025. Might be worth listening just to a bit of one of his campaign ads to get a sense of that.
I'll make buses fast and free,
so I can just get where I'm going.
I'll make childcare available to all New Yorkers at no cost.
I want to raise my kid in New York.
and I'll freeze the rent for every single rent-stabilized tenant.
These Eric Adams rent hikes are killing us.
So there's been a lot of talk about his riz, as they call it, charisma. But I don't know about you, I'm slightly skeptical about whether there's a broader lesson from this mayoral race for the rest of America, for the broader fight that the Democrats have on their hands against Donald Trump. I don't know how replicable it is.
I'm skeptical too. I mean, in that ad, he references two people that he was running against initially, Eric Adams and Andrew Cuomo. Eric Adams was the incumbent Democratic mayor who left office really surrounded by many allegations of fraud and corruption. And Andrew Cuomo, the New York Attorney General found, had sexually harassed 11 women who worked with him. So he didn't have a very strong field of candidates that he was running against here.
So I guess the question we're asking this week is whether Mamdani is the right person for the Democrats to look at or the wrong person. Is populism the answer for the progressive left in the same way that it has been for the hard right in America that's been such a successful recipe for Trump? Timothy Schenk is our guest. He's an historian of modern American politics at George Washington University, and he's written a thought-provoking essay for the New York Times called Democrats Are in Crisis. Eat the Rich Populism is the Only Answer. That's his theory anyway. We're going to put it to the test. Timothy Schenk, welcome to Global Roaming. And we should note for listeners that you've got a four-year-old in your vicinity watching Bluey as we talk to you.
Mm-hmm. So in case he breaks in at any moment, you have my preemptive apologies. But my thanks for letting me be here. I'm really excited.
What's the phraseology he's taken from the series, which he shouts at you?
Oh, that, well, he's really worried that I'm not playing footy with my mates right now. Like, he is also a fruit bat. So those who know Bluey will understand exactly what we're talking about.
This is Australian cultural dominance globally.
Soft power.
So listen, we're talking to you about Zoran Mamdani and the cut through that he's had, not just in New York politics, not just in American politics, but globally. For you, why does he cut through? What does he say? What does he tell you about this moment?
Well, the cut through reminds me more than anything of Barack Obama in 2008. And in both of those cases, I think it's this fresh outside figure who's coming along at a moment when a lot of people, not just in the United States, obviously, but around the world, are feeling pretty grim about the state of American politics. And just like Obama in 2008, Mamdani stands for the possibility that something could be really different, that the way things are now isn't the way they have to be. So he's a fresh, young, charismatic outsider who really does symbolize the turning of a page. To me, that makes for a pretty logical explanation.
But I guess the thing I just still can't quite wrap my head around is why this guy is cutting through the social media algorithms of people in their 20s in Australia, in countries all over the world. Like, why that?
Well, one part of it just has to be the importance of New York as a cultural capital, a cultural epicenter. We're not quite, it's not quite Bluey for toddlers, but it is still a place that definitely punches above its weight. And I think that if there's an answer, it probably has something to do with the fact that problems about affordability and a sense that the system just isn't working for ordinary people, same problems that, unfortunately, from my perspective, powered Donald Trump to the White House and have fueled a crisis for liberalism over the last 30-odd years and that have powered right-wing populist parties in much of the world. I think precisely the fact that these are global problems, Mamdani might point the way to a solution that extends not just outside New York City or the rest of the United States, but to other wealthy industrialized countries trying to figure out where we go from here.
Tim, I agree with you that it's clear that people voted for disruption in this election, and not just the New York mayoral election that happened this week, but in elections all over the US in this off-cycle year. But the big question is whether the Mamdani success can be scaled. And you've written about why you think it can be, why the Democratic Party, which is experiencing this historic three-decade low in approval, why you think that that is transferable. Tell us a bit about that theory.
Well, the extraordinary thing that Mamdani did, which turned this virtually unknown local politician into the next mayor of New York City, running against a three-time Democratic governor powerhouse in the form of Andrew Cuomo, how did he win? Simple. He cornered the market on the most important issue to voters, which is affordability. He spoke to those concerns clearly, cleanly, consistently in a way that no other candidate did. And what that did is it didn't just reach out to swing voters who are on the fence, but it mobilized progressive-based Democratic voters around that message too. And what's inspiring about Mamdani, thinking about what Democrats can learn on the national level from this example, is if you have candidates who can pull that same trick off of getting Democratic base voters who for the last 10 years have cared a lot about democracy, they've cared a lot about norms, not so much about pocketbook issues. If you can get them to invest in pocketbook issues, then you have a way of winning over voters who have been drifting to the right, blue collar, working class, who feel like the system isn't working for them. So turning Democrats not into the defenders of the establishment, but into authentic messengers for populist disaffection with the status quo, that's really what Mamdani stands for.
Tim, you just used the term pull that trick off. Is it a trick or is it a genuine, substantial policy panacea? Because from what I can tell, he's saying we're going to give you some free stuff and we're going to tax the rich. This is hardly revolutionary stuff.
Yeah, but there is, maybe this is the low standards of politics in general and American politics in particular, so the soft bigotry of low expectations. But the fact is that the way Mamdani campaigned, it was it was smart and it was disciplined. And one thing that he did so well that Democrats have struggled to do for a very long time, clear, simple policies that conveyed a sense of priorities and that picked fights around these pocketbook issues that almost turned Republicans back into their pre-Trump defenders of the billionaire class.
Tim, I think what we're trying to do here is unpick why he was so sort of breakout successful in this election. And to my mind, what the lesson is that charismatic politicians still go far. As you mentioned, he was relentlessly on message, on his cost of living message. He was very disciplined. He ran a very clever social media campaign. And he himself is a very personable and appealing personality. But I'm wondering on the national level how the Democrats can take someone who's so far left wing and sell that to people who, in look at 2016 and 2020, Bernie Sanders didn't do very well in primaries in either of those years, and in fact backtracked in 2020. If the Democratic base doesn't want Bernie Sanders because he's too left-wing, how can you sell that to the whole country?
So what I think it's important to say is that I totally agree. Charisma, that is an essential quality for any successful politician. You need it. But charisma by itself isn't enough. And again, Trump is, from my mind, an unfortunate example of the fact that, yes, he is a charismatic figure in his own terms. His fans absolutely love him. But why did he become such a popular national figure? It's because, just like Mamdani, he had his own set of issues that he drove home from the start and has been emphasizing consistently for years. In his case, it was anti-immigration, it was economic protectionism through tariffs, and it was anti-interventionist foreign policy, along with the generally conservative stance in the culture wars. And I think if Democrats can take inspiration from Mamdani, even if it's not going to be freeze the rent nationally, there are a host of proposals out there that are substantive, economic populist programs, including some really ambitious ones like a federal jobs guarantee, which looks a lot more attractive with the specter of AI. Those issues poll enormously well, and they cut across the divide between working, middle, and even some significant chunk of upper middle class voters. And if you can bring them together around an economic populist agenda that, yeah, will include taxing the rich, but not just that, then it's a way for Democrats to say, we're more than just the anti-Trump party. We are a party that's standing up for the little guy in concrete, tangible ways.
In your essay that you wrote in the New York Times arguing for this future for the Democratic Party, you mentioned another politician who is much less of a household name and who isn't even a Democrat. His name is Dan Osborne. Tell us why he's relevant to this conversation.
So the remarkable thing that Dan Osborne accomplished in 2024, he was running for the Senate for the first time. He's a union leader, college dropout, who is making his first serious political campaign. And he outperformed expectations relative to the partisan fundamentals of the election more than any other candidate that cycle. This guy, Dan Osborne, did better than any, in this case, not just any Democrat, but any Republican in that election. And what Osborne did was run an aggressively economic populist campaign while reaching out to Trump voters on cultural issues. And that's important in a state like Nebraska, where Trump absolutely slaughtered Kamala Harris. And what Osborne was able to do is say, if you care about immigration like Trump does, I'm with you too. He had a broadly kind of libertarian approach to a lot of Cold War issues where he was in favor of gun rights, but also in favor of decriminalizing marijuana. He was reaching out to voters on choice by saying that although he was a Catholic who was personally opposed to abortion, all of this was cutting a moderate to kind of conservative profile on cultural issues. But he said that at the end of the day, the questions that concerned him the most were these issues around economic populism, about sticking up for ordinary people in a billionaire's economy.
I grew up here, served in the Navy, worked as a mechanic. My friends, they just want a fair shot, and they know no party or politician has all the answers. It's why I've been an independent my whole life. I agree with the Republicans on taking on big government waste, Democrats on strengthening Social Security, President Trump on the economy, independents on the need to reform our government. I'll work with anyone in either party to lower costs, keep our communities safe, and serve Nebraska. I'm Dan Osborne, and I approve this message.
He would be, if elected, he's running again in 2026, the only member of the Senate, 100 people, without a college degree. That sort of tangible representation for working class Americans that is totally absent at the national level. And I think there's a reason why Bernie Sanders, who, even though, yes, he did not win the Democratic nomination in 2016 or 20, he is still, according to a lot of polls, the most popular elected official in the country in either party. I think there's a reason why Sanders has pointed to both Mamdani and to Osborne in their very different ways as models of how to run these working class populist campaigns.
The reason I struggle with this comparison, though, Tim, is that you mentioned he's taking stances on cultural issues that are outside lockstep with the left. He's able to do that because he's not a Democrat, and he says that he doesn't plan on becoming a Democrat. How does this work for a politician who is a Democrat, who has to appease the base, who doesn't want them to deviate from being pro-choice, who doesn't want them to align themselves with Trump on immigration? How do you bring the base along, even as you're appealing to that working class constituent who might have a slightly different perspective on cultural issues?
This is why you have to give people a common rallying point. And so in this piece for New York Times that you mentioned, I refer to the study that was done by actually a conservative Republican group of pollsters called Echelon Insights. And they split the American electorate into two chunks. They asked about economic issues and cultural issues. And they found that on a whole range of questions, you could basically split on the culture war, Americans have fought it to a gridlock. It's about 47-49, country that's a little bit more conservative on the whole on these cultural issues. On economic issues, though, it's a total rout for the liberals. It's 70-30. Now, there are divides within this liberal coalition over issues like climate change, but it's clear that economic populism has, there's a hunger for that in the American electorate that Trump has been able to appeal to, and that weirdly Democrats have struggled to over the last 10 years. So if you can polarize the electorate, not around the culture war issues that Trump likes to lean into, but around those economic issues, that is not just the best path for Democrats to put together a winning coalition today. For almost a century now, going back to the New Deal in the 1930s, that has consistently been the best strategy for Democrats to put together large, durable national majorities.
I think it's maybe worth playing a little bit of Zoran Mamdani for listeners, trying to thread the needle in the way that you're describing, because I think it in itself demonstrates exactly the tactic that you're addressing there. Here he is at one of his rallies, essentially going explicitly after the people that support Trump.
I fight for working people. I fight for the very people that have been priced out of this city. And I fight for the same people that he said he was fighting for. This is the same president who ran on a campaign of cheaper groceries, who ran on a campaign about easing a suffocating cost of living crisis. And ultimately, it is easier for him to fan the flames of division than to acknowledge the ways in which he has betrayed those working class Americans.
Okay, so that's Zoran Mamdani there. Does this mean that the Democrats are basically saying we can't beat this guy on those terms? We're just going to agree to those terms? Is that how you're interpreting this, or it's just clever?
I think it's more getting in touch with what the Democratic Party has been at its best. There have been times when American politics is split along those economic lines, when Democrats really were the party of working people. That in the United States was roughly the 1930s into the 1960s. And that also happens to have been the time from the New Deal and Social Security down to the Great Society and the Civil Rights Revolution. Democrats were able to deliver the major social programs that truly transformed life for ordinary people. And throughout that period, and even down into the Bill Clinton and Barack Obama years, Democrats were able to put together this broad coalition grounded in the working and middle class voters who had lots of issues that divided them on the cultural front, but had common economic interests that they came together to promote.
I was interested that you finally got to Bill Clinton there. Now, he's very much persona non grata in the Democratic Party these days. And yet I kept thinking, are you just advocating for a return to it's the economy, stupid? Or is this different from Clintonian populism or third way democratic theory?
I will say, this is, I'm going to plug my latest book, Left Adrift, What Happened to Liberal Politics, where I look very closely at those fights among Clinton-era political consultants. And it turns out that it's the economy stupid has a kind of surprisingly radical back history to it. So that's James Carville's famous phrase. But he works closely, his longtime business partner is this guy named Stan Greenberg, who is kind of the brains behind the operation. Carville's the guy who's great on TV. Stan Greenberg is the one with a PhD from Harvard who was working on this.
Is Carville the beauty behind the operation then?
Can he be the beast and the beauty? open to debate. But Greenberg, actually, when he was his Harvard PhD back in the 1960s, he was also a lefty academic reading Gramsci and Marx and all the rest. And he saw his entire life's purpose in politics as figuring out a way to bring working class voters back into not just Democratic Party, but he became one of these global celebrity consultants like James Carville, who was working for Tony Blair in the UK, Ehud Barak in Israel, Gerhard Schroeder in Germany, Nelson Mandela in South Africa. And time and again, Greenberg encouraged candidates to run, like Clinton actually did in 1992, on this economic populist, culturally moderate message that was focused like a laser beam, not just at winning elections, but on bringing disaffected working class voters back into the Democratic Party. Now, Greenberg would be the first one to acknowledge that in practice, Clinton governed much more like a progressive neoliberal than the economic populist that he campaigned as on the trail. But the fact is that working class voters supported Bill Clinton in numbers in 1992 and 1996 that Democrats would absolutely kill for today. And somewhat more inspiring to me as a progressive, they did the same thing for Barack Obama. Not saying that Democrats have to go back to the full New Deal coalition in one fell swoop, but I'm saying that if they could even get working class voters back to where they were in 2012, that could be transformative for the party.
I think probably it's fair to observe that a lot of Australians look at America today and think, why on earth is no one really standing up tall and opposing Trump? Where's the effective opposition? What's wrong with the Democrats? Why can't they figure out a way through this, given that no matter how much support he might have had electorally, there's some pretty controversial and surprising things that Trump is doing that undermine core American values? And I noticed in that speech that Mamdani gave after winning, he spoke directly to Trump. You know, these four, I've got four words for you because I know you're watching. Turn up the volume.
So Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have four words for you. Turn the volume up.
Is this the guy that stands up to Trump? Is this the beginning of like an effective opposition to Trump? Or is this just maybe an instruction card, a how-to manual for someone else to do it? And who is that person?
So I think he's one of many voices that will be standing up to Trump. And I think he'll be a particularly effective messenger for progressive causes. Although I will say the worrier in me is concerned that Trump is going to try and break Mondani, that this is going to be one of the first items on his agenda, from withholding federal funds to New York City to potentially staging some sort of showdown with ICE in the streets of Manhattan or the Bronx or Queens, put in your borough here. I can imagine different ways in which this gets really ugly really quick. And for anyone who hopes that Mamdani could be a transformative figure in the way that New York mayors during the Great Depression were, Fiore LaGuardia was a New York mayor when FDR was in office, and Mamdani's often cite inspiration. The unfortunate thing is that LaGuardia had FDR to work with, and Mamdani has Trump to go to war against. But I think that it's also important to note that at the same time that Mamdani won in New York, Democrats had a really good night last night in off-year elections in a wide variety of states. I'm talking to you from suburban Virginia, which just elected a Democratic governor by a landslide margin. New Jersey, the same thing. And what you see, I don't think there's going to be one central opposition Trump figure, just because in a presidential system like the United States, where Democrats don't have a formal leader, no party has a formal leader. It's either the president or it's a presidential nominee. So you're not going to get a clear face of the Democratic Party until 2028, by which time Trump is probably going to be a rearview mirror.
But is that slightly letting the Democrats off the hook, though? Like, love or loathe Trump, he was an effective opposition figure from the moment he left office until the moment he came back.
But he's the former president. That is the exception that proves the rule, I think. Republicans, when Barack Obama took over, were leaderless and adrift in 2017. Democrats took a while.
But come on, is this just a bit more of the kind of doe-eyed, democratic, you know, hope rubbish that hasn't really worked?
The pragmatic case here is that the way that our political cycle works is that we're going to have the so the elections this last night were absolutely brutal. They were the first serious elections in the Trump second term. And what's going to happen next are the midterms, where all of the House of Representatives and a third of the Senate and tons of gubernatorial seats and local races, that's going to be all up this time next year. And the best thing Democrats can do, this is not a long-term strategy for saving the party, but the best short-term thing they can do is just be not Trump. Time and again, for midterm elections, it's a referendum on the party in power. Now, when it comes to winning a presidential election, that's when you need to have a positive vision. But just because they're structurally disempowered right now and gathering up the anti-Trump resistance into one big coalition as the order of the day, it kind of makes sense, even though I agree it feels morally unsatisfying in some deep way.
Tim, just quickly, I have to ask, you know who else had a good night last night? Was Gavin Newsom. Because in California, voters approved his new congressional map, which is designed to counter what Trump has been doing to redistrict in more Republican states. I imagine you're not a fan of Gavin Newsom. He's not quite the economic populist that you're advocating for here. Do you think he's a contender for 2028 for the Democrats?
So there was a really fascinating report that came out from a group of actually more moderate Democrats last week, and was looking at the electoral landscape, paths ahead for the party. There's some things I disagreed with in there, some things I really agreed with. And one striking thing that I took away from that report, they looked at different candidates for 2028, potential presidential candidates. And they said, based on their past electoral performance, how would we expect them to do at a national level? And they ranked them from their predictions for the very strongest candidates to the very weakest candidates. Very strongest candidates were some pretty more obscure figures, but if you're in American politics, you know their names. The very worst candidate that they had was Gavin Newsom, the person who, if you scale them up to a national level, a progressive Democrat from California who oozes politician from every pore, and who is the guy who during COVID invited his buddies to a special party, the French Laundry, one of the most expensive restaurants in the world. Listen, he is a charismatic figure too. He's compelling. He has won this last year of Democrat. If the Democrat presidential nomination were being held today, he would probably win because he has been this effective face of Trump resistance. But my hope is that Democratic voters will see both that he seems to be toxic with the swing voters that they need to win a general election, and that he really has gotten to this position as face of the resistance by copying Trump. It's replicating him. It's being provocative jerk on social media in the way that Trump is, and that the face of the next Democratic Party can't be Zohra Mamdani, wasn't born in the United States, but someone who is at more of that optimistic break from Trump. David Axelrod, one of Barack Obama's former presidential advisors, always likes to say that Americans after the presidency, they're looking for a remedy, not a reaction. And Gavin Newsom is a reaction, and I hope Democrats will be smart enough to pick a remedy.
Tim, you've given us a lot to think about. Enjoy Bluey.
Always do.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks so much.
So, Amelia, reflections on Tim.
I want to buy what he's selling. He has a very neat, simple solution to the Democrats' crisis. But I keep seeing shortcomings and things that make me question his diagnosis and cure. What about you?
It's the riddle, I guess, that is so hard for Australians, I think, to contend with, because our conventional wisdom is, well, you know, whenever these parties end up out of favour and, you know, in dire straits, they've just got to find their way back to the centre. That's where elections are won. But America, you know, because of the lack of compulsory voting, the need to motivate the base, it's just a far more complex question and answer, I think. And I don't know yet that I've heard anything convincing that the answer is two very big parties at the sort of real fringes of what their base will accept and run along with.
Yeah, particularly since we've seen that the parties suffer from asymmetric polarization. So
what does that mean?
What that means is that if you are the Republican base, you want to go further right to the right than what the Democratic base wants to go to the left. And we saw that in the reason why Bernie didn't win his primaries in 2016 and 2020 is because the Democratic base is not sold on democratic socialism. They don't want to go that far left. Now, the Republican Party seems to be pushing the boundaries every day of how far right they want to go. I'm just not sold on this idea that Americans want a sort of radical redistribution of wealth in the type of rhetoric that Mandami's been using.
I suppose as well, just for me, there's always that nagging sense that you still got to get enough people in the middle to vote.
Yeah.
One way or the other. You still got to get them out and you got to offer them something.
Exactly. Yeah. And you do need fireworks. One other big issue that I have with what Tim was saying is that you notice how he harks back to the 1930s to the 1960s as the last time Democrats successfully employed his strategy.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, and yeah, he thinks they're okay, but you can tell that he doesn't love their neoliberal turn. So my question is, we don't have a model of how to win elections with this kind of democratic socialist class populism rhetoric. And it hasn't happened in a long time.
But I think, and you know, at the start of that interview, I found it hard, and I often do find it hard to get Americans to move beyond the presentation, the sell, to the substance.
That's interesting.
And I just, not that there's anything wrong with his analysis, but I think for me anyway, even though Americans are dazzled by the sell, there's still got to be some policy substance there that is going to change someone's mind quietly.
So are you saying that you think Americans are more susceptible to riz, as the young people call charisma, than Australians are?
Not necessarily, but I guess we don't have so much riz in our politics when we look at our leaders. And I think the compulsory voting means that there always has to be a little bit more substance. You know, there's a lot of complaints about the debates in the lead up to our federal election being boring. Mm. They were really boring. They were. We don't have these sort of great orators, but I think there's another way at looking at that same scenario and saying, well, hang on, whether you like Dutton or Albanese or don't like either of them, they carried off a number of long debates full of policy substance.
Mm.
Whether you liked the substance is a different question, but they were capable of doing that, and that's where the argument sat. And to me, that just still seems missing from some of this in America.
That's really interesting. I'd never thought about the fact that Australians, basically every Australian knows what negative gearing is.
Totally.
I don't think Americans are that deep in their tax code.
We had a German diplomat friend visiting around the time of the election here in Australia, watched some of the debates, a political obsessive, and he was like, I cannot believe how much detail was discussed about taxation policy.
And he's German.
Yeah.
That's really telling.
So, recommendations, Amelia, what are you sending our way?
I've got something a little bit related to what we've been chatting about today. There's a new publication out called Equator. So far, it's just online, but it's going to eventually be in print too. It's been founded by a number of, I guess I'd call them cosmopolitan intellectuals, among them Pankaj Mishra.
Okay. Global elites.
Global elites, yes, exactly. And I think he's one of the clearest thinkers on this strange moment we're in, where the US has sort of abdicated its global leadership entirely and is thinking about what has to come next. So they founded this publication to get at that question. And one of my favorite articles from the launch issue came from a University of Chicago professor called Adom Getachew. She writes about why her Ethiopian relatives voted for Donald Trump. And it's the most nuanced and very personal reflection on a trend, an inescapable trend from the 2024, which was we saw first-generation immigrants defecting from the Democratic Party, which was their traditional home, and going over to vote for Donald Trump, someone who is overtly anti-immigrant. So she explores that paradox, comes up with some really interesting answers, among them the fact that Joe Biden really fumbled the American response to the Ethiopian Civil War. But there's also some much deeper and fascinating theories about why that might be, including the fact that immigrants to the U.S. now, rather than being greeted by public institutions like unions or community centers, now very much assimilate through private channels like WhatsApp and social media.
Interesting. I will read that. I'm going to recommend a piece of your work, Amelia, because you're amongst the Boyer lecturers this year, and your lecture actually goes out Sunday, 9th of November on Radio National at 8 a.m. And you're looking sort of at AI, I think, in the context of the broader question that's been put to the Boyers this year.
That's right. The broader question of challenges to our democracy is what I was addressing and talking about AI within. And basically what I'm saying is we need to stop being technology takers in Australia. We need to stop being governed by this neoliberal model of taking what the tech companies throw at us and accepting it and then cleaning up the mess afterwards, as we saw with the social media ban, and start making our own rules about how we use technology and specifically the guardrails we want to put in place around AI.
You can catch that on Radio National, or you can find the Boyer Lectures on the ABC Listen app. And you wanted to slightly double up with your recommendations, and Larissa Berendt is one of the, well, Geraldine does it every second week, so.
Yes, Larissa Berendt is another one of the Boyer lecturers this year, and I wanted to particularly shout out her lecture, which aired last Sunday. That is basically looking at how our democracy has never been as inclusive as it could be. But one particular point that she made that really stuck with me is she talks about how we always look to these Western models of democracy and inclusive government. Like we talk about the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans, and we sometimes talk about America and France. But she points out that Indigenous people have been in this country for some 70,000 years, and not only did they have to figure out how to develop a relationship with the land that was sustainable, they had to figure out how to get along with each other as well. So we might think about models of governance that come from Indigenous cultures as well.
Very thought-provoking lecture from Larissa. Thanks for all of your feedback. We've had a lot on our recent China episodes. I promise once Geraldine is back, we're going to tackle some of those responses. By the way, lots of suggestions coming in for other episodes at the moment, including on Myanmar, Venezuela, which we are totally fascinated with, but also the tragic situation unfolding in the Sudan. We are looking into those topics. I promise you we're seeing your feedback, global.roaming@abc.net.au. That's our email address. Thanks to our producer, Taryn Priyadko. And Amelia, thank you very much for stepping in.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.